We're now going to go specifically to a portion of Pierre Decaux's analysis of the scapegoating of French socialists for the French defeat by the very French fascists and collaborationists who had participated in the Cagoule, the Fifth Column, and who later basically became the principal operatives of the Vichy fascist collaborationist government. First, we're going to take a look at General Weygand. He was one of the reactionary French generals and a general who literally surrendered the French army. And by the way, this was parroted by Maréchal Pétain to save it to, quote, fight communism, unquote. By the way, we've touched on this also in the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, a book that we'll be dealing with in weeks to come. Of the need to, quote, preserve the honor of the army in the wake of the French defeat, Pierre Coe writes as follows. First of all, it was necessary to, quote, preserve the honor of the army, unquote. General Weygand thundered these words like a command. He used, unconsciously, the same terms that leaders of the French army had invoked during the Dreyfus affair to prevent public opinion from discovering their criminal mistakes. Preserve the honor of the army, to French military men, is to secure by every means, including those outlawed by moral law and the penal code, the defense of the military corporation. The question of the responsibility of military leaders in the military defeat of France either had to be evaded or posed in distorted terms. To, quote, preserve the honor of the army, unquote, the scapegoats of the defeat had to be chosen from among the political personnel of the Third Republic. And skipping down, as we shall see, many of the French generals whose combination of blundering and deliberate subversion had led to the French defeat in 1940 became a key elements of the Pétain-Vichy collaborationist government, the government that collaborated with the German fascists. Skipping down in the Triumph of Treason, Pierre Coe writes, the severest condemnation, that of the generals who'd lost the war, and again, the loss was through a combination of what was no doubt sincere, albeit incredible bungling, and a deliberate sabotage, deliberate subversion on the part of officers of a Cagoular mindset, so to speak. Exactly where the blundering left off and the fascist subversion begins is anybody's guess, but Pierre Coe makes an excellent case that there was plenty of both, and his was an excellent vantage point. Continuing now with Pierre Coe's account, the severest condemnation came from the soldiers themselves. Lost on the roads in pursuit of dispersed divisions and phantom regiments, thrown together with the refugees whose uncertainties and anxieties they shared, the men in uniform cursed the conduct of their leaders. They repeated that they never had been schooled in the techniques of modern warfare, especially in the combined use of tanks and aviation, and they were amazed at the ineptness of their commanders in the battles of May and June. They asked why the Meuse and Seine bridges had not been blown up before the arrival of German motorized columns, why Paris had not been defended street by street, as the Spanish Republicans had defended Madrid, and as the Russians were to defend Stalingrad. And they wanted to know why more than half the tanks and airplanes had been left in the rear, in Orléans, Toulouse, Lyon, North Africa, instead of being massed for a counterattack that might have changed everything. They knew that the depot were bursting with the cannon, airplanes, and equipment they needed. I would note that many of the heavy armored vehicles and aircraft that the French had not thrown into battle against the Germans were later inherited by the Germans to use against the Soviets and British. Continuing. One began to hear quoted the disturbing remarks with which General Weygand had tried to persuade the cabinet to ask for an armistice, that he needed his tanks to master the revolutionary elements if it should become necessary. That is to say, the commander-in-chief of the French army preferred fighting French workers to throwing all his forces against the German troops. The soldiers praised the bravery of certain leaders, Giraud, Letien, de Gaulle, Lucien, Delattre de Tassigny, and many others, but they declared that most of the officers had been the first to flee. And again, note that General Weygand is talking about harboring his armored units, his tanks, to use against, quote, subversive or revolutionary elements, in other words, French workers who might try to overthrow the Vichy government. Continuing. Of the officers who fled, quote, they left in automobiles and we left on foot, unquote. They said, talking about these officers, faithful followers of L'Action Française, Je suis partout, Gringoire, and other fascist newspapers, which had said in various forms during the winter that this was a democratic war and consequently did not interest them. These statements circulated throughout the country, especially among the working classes and in petit bourgeois circles, which in France have always shown a quicker and sharper intelligence than other social groups. The criticisms of the general staff were perhaps exaggerated, but confused as they were, they represented popular opinion. By June of 1940, not one man, unless he were directly involved, would have defended the general staff. The most indulgent spoke of incompetence, the most severe of betrayal, and the latter were in the majority. Moreover, available information about war prisoners indicated that these unfortunates were still more bitter against their leaders than were their comrades in France. Their anger was legitimate. It was inexplicable, after all, that the general staff, after deciding to abandon Paris and thus opening the east to the Germans, had not ordered the troops which occupied the Maginot Line to fall back toward the south. More than 1 million men, the best of the French army, were caught in the German trap, a disaster which could have been prevented by an order from General Weygand. The most plausible explanation of this, quote, error, unquote, occurring spontaneously to the prisoners of war was that General Weygand, fearing the fury of his soldiers more than he did the enemy, and preferring the defeat of France to revolutionary outbreaks, allowed the youngest and most ardent men of the French army to be locked up in German prisons rather than see them scattered through France. Thus, France was covered by a great wave of anti-militarism, scorn for the stupidity of the general staff, and deep resentment against certain leaders who were considered particularly suspect. Gagged by Maréchal Pétain, and with only censored newspapers to read, France was not free to express any opinion, but the people were unanimous in thinking that the army leaders had not been up to the level of their task. An impartial inquiry not exempting the general staff would have been the normal outlet for public feeling. By the way, I would interject, in fact, a large percentage of the French population was totally apathetic during the occupation. Some were critical of the leadership. I think Pierre Coe's viewpoint here is that of the optimistic patriot rather than the informed cynic, because in fact, most of the majority of French people either actively collaborated with the fascist occupation or were apathetic. Comparatively few actually became active résistants. Continuing. Vichy neither would, although I would note that the explanations for some of the monumental blunders of the French general staff has been no satisfactory explanation put forth by their defenders. Continuing, Vichy neither could nor would order such a dangerous investigation. By its composition, the government of Vichy was representative not of the French people, but of the general staff. Its first cabinets were headed by Pétain, the spiritual leader of the French army, the man who had played the most important part in the preparation of the war and in the formation of the general staff. And these cabinets were composed largely of members of the general staff: General Weygand, General Pujol, Admiral Darlan, General Hunsinger, General Bergeret, and Admiral Platon. As the French proverb says, the wolves do not eat each other, unquote. Thus, the first problem which faced the government of Vichy, confronted by the political and psychological consequences of the military defeat, was to divert to political men the ever-growing anger against the leaders of the army. The French growled, "We have been betrayed or deceived by the generals," unquote. Proclamations and propaganda were to transform this into, quote, "The generals were admirable, but you have been betrayed and deceived by your own representatives," unquote. Every device had to be employed to replace the reality of military responsibility by the legend of political responsibility. As we shall see in a minute, what the Vichy collaborationist government, and again François Mitterrand, apparently very cozy with that government, did was to blame elected representatives of the Léon Blum government for the blunders and deliberate subversion which they themselves were the author. As we shall see, too, the Vichy government not only incorporated many of the military leaders who were responsible for the combination of blundering and subversion which led to France's defeat, but they also incorporated many members of the Fifth Column, including, and this is most noteworthy here, people who had been involved with the Cagoulard coup plot, with those clandestine cells which attempted to overthrow the French democracy in 36, 37, and 38. The next section of Pierre Coe's A Triumph of Treason from 1944 is called Save the Fifth Column, and it reads, "But what political men should be chosen to bear the onus of the defeat? Here again, the choice was determined by circumstances. On the one hand, the government wanted to destroy democracy and establish in France a fascist political regime and a corporate economic system. Maréchal Pétain's object in taking power, or as he pompously said, making his country the gift of his person, had not been to permit the French nation to heal its wounds, come to itself, and determine freely its own political, economic, and social institutions. His publicly avowed purpose was to overthrow the Republican regime, suppress local and governmental civil liberties, quote, purify the French nation by punishing it, unquote, and bring France back to the social and religious disciplines of the Ancien Régime. To achieve this purpose, Maréchal Pétain and his ministers were not satisfied with the support of the German government. They also needed the support of French enemies of democracy and of the fascist organizations. On the other hand, and herein lay their difficulty, a spirit of animosity was growing in popular circles against these same anti-democratic and fascist elements, based on a growing awareness that the Fifth Column had played a preponderant part in the disaster, a part as grave and as sinister as that played by the incompetence of military leaders. In June and July of 1940, most of the French people were less concerned with the public utterances of Maréchal Pétain and his ministers than with the pro-fascist and pro-Hitler tendencies of the supporters of the new government. Most of the ministers were unknown. The Marshal's backers included all of the enemies of the Republic, all the men whom the French people had learned to distrust. Morat, the doctrinaire of l'Action Française, who had incessantly praised fascist regimes, by the way, that's M-A-U-R-R-A-S, Flandin, F-L-A-N-D-I-N, who had telegraphed congratulations to Hitler after the rape of Czechoslovakia in September of 1938, Marcel Deya, who in August of 1939 had written a notorious article asking the French soldiers, quote, not to die for Danzig, unquote, Bonnet, B-O-N-N-E-T, who had destroyed the Franco-Soviet pact by his negotiations with von Ribbentrop, Colonel Casimir François de la Roque and Jacques Doriot, leaders of the two largest fascist and anti-Semitic organizations, and Laval, that's Pierre Laval, who already symbolized, quote, collaboration with the new order. Of course, de la Roque, head of the Croix de Fer, a fellow we read about in Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum. And again, these are some of the principal supporters of Maréchal Pétain. Obviously, people deeply involved with not only the Fifth Column, but also the Cagoulard coup movement. Continuing, recouping that last sentence. Among the people, Colonel Casimir François de la Roque and Jacques Doriot, leaders of the two largest fascist and anti-Semitic organizations, and Laval, who already symbolized collaboration with the new order, whose intrigues and negotiations with Mussolini and Franco were known, and whose intrigues and negotiations with Hitler were suspected. Moreover, the French people saw that every true patriot in public office refused to support Pétain and his government. Not only communists and socialists, but also conservatives and liberals such as Jean Monnet, president of the Senate, Louis Marin, disciple of Poincaré and leader of the French conservatives, Compatier de Ribes, head of the Catholic group of the Démocrate Populaire, and Herriot, whose talent and thought incarnated so brilliantly the patriotic tradition of the French Revolution. To their astonishment, the French people saw Pétain slowly fill the most important posts of authority in local, departmental, and central administrations with men who had taken part in the Cagoulard plot, with those who had repeated the infamous refrain, quote, rather Hitler than Léon Blum, unquote, and even with some of those who before or during the war had been arrested for treasonable domestic and foreign activities. And again, note the incorporation of former Cagoulard into the Vichy government of Pétain, with which François Mitterrand was very cozy. Recapping this last sentence, to their astonishment, the French people saw Pétain slowly fill the most important posts of authority in local, departmental, and central administrations with men who had taken part in the Cagoulard plot, with those who had repeated the infamous refrain, rather Hitler than Léon Blum, and even with some of those who before or during the war had been arrested for treasonable domestic and foreign activities. The people were applying to the government the old proverb, quote, tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are, unquote. They were alarmed to see Vichy employ for its most delicate missions Ferdinand de Brinon, Jean Montigny, Jean Goy, Jean Loucher, and Gaston-Henri A., members of the Comité France-Allemagne, an organization which, before the war, had been inspired and financed by Otto Abetz, A-B-E-T-Z, after 1940, Hitler's ambassador in Paris. They learned with fury that on the night of the armistice, when France was in mourning, Frenchmen and Frenchwomen of the aristocracy, high finance, and industry had drunk at Bordeaux to the defeat which had rid them of the nightmare of democracy and of the popular front. The people understood that the fifth column in France, as in Spain, had opened the door to Hitler's agents. And they watched with awe the agents of the fifth column become masters of France, the France of Pétain, Weygand, and Laval. The new rulers of France soon realized the danger which was threatening them and their friends. To establish French fascism, fascism had to be rehabilitated. To suppress democracy, democracy had to be dishonored. To achieve its ends, the Vichy government had to, quote, preserve the honor of the army, unquote, and save the honor of the French friends and accomplices of Hitler and Mussolini. The scapegoats would be useful not only to mask the military errors of Pétain, Weygand, and their generals, but also to cover up the political crimes of Laval and his accomplices. Because the French grumbled, quote, we have been betrayed by Hitler's agents and deceived by the partisans of fascism, unquote, the Vichy propaganda had to repeat incessantly, quote, the traitors are not the men you accuse. Hitler's partisans are good patriots, friends of peace, as the partisans of fascism are good citizens, friends of order. But you have been precipitated into war and deceived by those Democrats who were blinded by the hate of fascism and dominated by Judeo-communist influences. By every means, the reality of fascist treachery had to be replaced by the legend of democratic irresponsibility. And what Pierre Coe goes on to discuss next is the Riom trials, that's spelled R-I-O-M, in which many of the political leaders of the Popular Front under Léon Blum were put on trial, and they were blamed for the collapse of France rather than the combination of incompetence and deliberate subversion of the Cagoule and the fifth columnists. We're not going to have time this evening to complete the last part of what I intended to complete. In fact, we're going to run well into the next broadcast with this. I have been going into these events, which took place a half century ago or more, by way of not only gaining some understanding of just what the political milieu that the Prime Minister of France was a part of, but beyond that, in the clandestine cellular organizational methodology of German Nazism as conceived by Adolf Hitler, and his use of what another anti-fascist writer, Kurt Ries, termed in a book of this name, quote, total espionage, unquote, we're going to see a direct reflection of the clandestine cellular methodological operational technique of fascism in the current Nazi movements in both Germany and Austria. In the September 20th, 1992 installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, we dealt with the Third Reich preparations to go underground with military defeat. The Third Reich did not disappear, as is popularly supposed, but rather, in anticipation of military defeat, the Third Reich organized itself politically into an underground organization based on a clandestine cellular structure. We saw that by 1953, when the Naumann coup attempt unsuccessfully failed to unseat the superficial democracy which had been installed in Germany after the war and which continues to prevail in Germany. It is a very thin democratic veneer indeed. But when some Third Reich veterans attempted to overthrow the thin veneer of democracy in Germany, the subsequent investigation by the British occupation authorities revealed that in fact Germany was being run by remote control, so to speak, by what was described as a Führungsring, an infrastructure of mafia-like control which was affected by small cells, just exactly the sort of clandestine cellular structure, or cellular organizational structure, which the Nazis, as described by Kurt Ries in his book, The Nazis Go Underground, had envisioned. That cellular structure was put in place and ran Germany effectively after the war. What we're going to do in next week's installment of Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce is we're going to jump ahead in time from 1944, 50 years ago, when Pierre Coe was describing the Cagoulards and their evolution into the Fifth Column movement, which collaborated with Hitler and helped to subvert France in the face of the Nazi invasion. It then blossomed into the Pétain Vichy fascist collaborationist government, of which François Mitterrand, with which François Mitterrand was very, very cozy. We're going to jump ahead in time to 1994, and specifically we're going to take a look at two very important articles from the August 1994 issue of The Searchlight, again, the British anti-fascist weekly. We're going to take a look at an article called March Separately, Strike Together, The Expansion of the Illegal NSDAP. And what we're going to take a look at is the organization of the Nazi forces in Germany into seemingly disparate groups, seemingly small, disorganized, unconnected groups, but which are in fact not only connected to each other, but which are administered by a clandestine NSDAP, the illegal NSDAP. NSDAP stands for National Socialist Deutscher Arbeiterpartei. That is the formal name of the German Nazi Party under Hitler. And what we're going to take a look at next week are two articles back-to-back in the August 1994 issue of The Searchlight, which describe the clandestine cellular organization of the contemporary Nazi organizations in Germany and how they not only are connected to each other, although seemingly seemingly disparate and unconnected, but how these organizations have a direct operational continuity with the Nazi cells that survived the Third Reich's military defeat, that were present in Germany in the immediate post-World War II period, and which basically were administering German society through what author T.H. Tetens termed the Führungsring. As incredible as it may seem to the uninitiated, the Nazi parties in Germany are not the small groups of disconnected skinheads. In fact, these groups are all connected and controlled behind the scenes by a clandestine Nazi structure which works directly with the German authorities. We've seen in the past with the Germany Alert newsletter how the German Nazi parties are actually manipulated by the BND as vehicles for covert operations. What we're going to look at next week is how the organizational methodology devised by Adolf Hitler, the synthesis of espionage methodology with political methodology, is in effect today with the Nazi parties in Germany, and we are going to see that same methodology in effect in contemporary Austria today, because Nazi forces organized along the same lines envisioned by Adolf Hitler after World War II, and organized along very similar lines to the Cagular in the pre-World War II period in France. Nazi forces organized along precisely that clandestine cellular pattern are on the march and are gathering steam in both Austria and Germany, and in both countries they are directly connected not only to the government but have strong connections going all the way back to the Nazi cells in the immediate post-World War II period. Again, next week we'll begin with March Separately, Strike Together, the expansion of the illegal NSDAP, and we will see just how Hitler's ideas have and his methodology has evolved into the present period. Let me remind you again of September 17th. That is a Saturday. On that day, I'm going to be lecturing in room F12 of the Foothill College campus. The subject, the Iran-Contra scandal, a look back and a glance ahead. This will be a fundraiser for KFJC-FM. For further information, call area code 415-949-7099. That concludes things for me for this evening. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening, and good night.
Tape cassettes of Dave Emery's archive documentaries and weekly One Step Beyond programs are available from a tape duplication service. The service is Archives on Audio, and you can contact them at Post Office Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. Once again, that's P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number and area code are 415-346-1840. A 12-page catalog listing and describing each archive show is available. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC make money from the sale of the tapes.
To subscribe to The Searchlight, a British anti-fascist publication, write to Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B, New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, or phone 011-4471-284-4040 or fax 011-4471-284-4410. That's the Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR. Phone 011-4471-284-4040 or fax at 011-4471-284-4410.
Opinions expressed on KFJC are not necessarily those of its staff or management. Responsible parties with opposing views may be provided time to air those views. For more information, write the Public Affairs Director at KFJC, 12345 El Monte Road, Los Altos Hills, California, 94022.